It was more than mere chance, and old Karanga's faltering guidance that had led her, Robin decided exultantly, as she followed her new guide along one of the narrow winding game paths. It was blood calling to blood. Instinctively, like a migrating swallow, she had flown straight to her father. She felt like shouting aloud, singing her joy to the forest, while the woman went swiftly ahead of Robin, her narrow, smoothly muscled back and shoulders hardly moved above the gliding roll of her hips. That graceful walk of the African woman, trained from childhood to carry a burden upon her head so smoothly that not a drop spills from a brimming pot. She did not move swiftly enough for Robin's expectations. Already Robin could imagine the powerful figure of her father striding towards her, the great flaming bush of his beard, the deep compelling voice as he called her name, and swung her high as he had when she was a child, then the crushing embrace of his arms. She imagined his joy matching hers, and after the first heady moments of reunion, then the serious hours of discussion, the recital of the long years between, the growing trust and intimacy between them that they had lacked before, so that finally they could march together to a common goal. In the long years ahead, he could hand the torch to her, confident that his faith and work would go forward in loving and loyal hands. What would be his first words when he saw and recognized her? How immense his surprise! She laughed aloud breathlessly. Of course he would be deeply touched and grateful that she had come so far, so determinedly to be with him, and she, Robin, knew that she would not be able to hold back her own tears of joy. She could imagine her father tenderly wiping them away. The tone of his voice would betray the pent-up love of all the intervening years that had parted them, and which would be so sweet that she could hardly bear it. Ahead of her, in the fading light of a dying day, the Mashona woman led them on to a steep pathway, climbing at a traverse across the western slope of the highest hill. Robin laughed again when she realized that it was the same hill that old Karanga had pointed out from 20 miles away. He had been right in the end. She must praise him lavishly for that. In her own happiness, she wanted to give joy to all the world. The path came out on a level shelf just below the crest, with a shallow cliff at the back of it, and the slope of the hill falling away steeply towards the sunset, and a breathtaking view across the forest and savannah. The entire land turned pink and gold in the low sun, and the stupendous flat-topped thunderheads of cloud rose along the dark blue horizon. The setting was right for this magical moment, but Robin glanced at it only once, and then her full attention fastened on what lay ahead of her. In the face of the cliff was the mouth of a low cave. The slanting rays of the sun struck fully into it, showing that it was not very deep, but had been occupied for a long time. The roof and walls were blackened with the soot of the cooking fire. The floor had been swept bare, except for the fire at the entrance, with its circle of blackened hearthstones and a small clay pot standing upon them. The clearing in front of the cave was bare also, trodden by feet over many years, and there was the offal of human occupation scattered about it, the bare bones of small animals, scraps of fur, chips of wood and shards of broken pottery. There was the odour of rotting food fragments, unwashed leather garments, wood smoke and human excrement that confirmed the other evidence that men had lived here for a long time. There was a single human figure crouched over the smoky little fire, an old crone, bowed by age, a mere bundle of filthy fur blankets, moth-eaten and ragged, looking more like an ancient ape than a human being. It did not stir, and Robin barely glanced at it, for something else held her attention. In the back of the cave, lit by the last fleeting sunlight, stood a bed. It was made of rudely cut poles and tied together with bark rope, yet it stood on four legs in European style, not the African sleeping mat, and it was piled with a stained fur kaross that might have contained a human shape. On a ledge directly above the bed stood a brass telescope, a teak box similar to the one that held Zuga's sextant and chronometer, but scarred and battered with age, and a small, cheap tin chest. The chest was much battered also, most of the original paint chipped away, so the bare metal showed. Robin remembered that box so vividly, open in Uncle William's study at King's Lynn, the papers from it overflowing onto the desktop, and her father bowed over them, steel-rimmed spectacles on the end of his beaked nose, tugging at his thick red beard as he worked. Robin gave a little choking cry and ran forward, passing the old crone sitting at the fire, crossing the cave, and flinging herself on her knees beside the crude bedstead. "Peter!" her voice husked over with emotion, rasped her own throat. "Peter, it's me, Robin." There was no movement beneath the fur blanket, and she put out a hand and then stopped before it touched. "He's dead," she thought miserably. "I am too late." She forced her hand to move again and touched the malodorous pile of old furs. They collapsed under her touch, and it took her seconds to realize that she had been mistaken. The bed was empty. The discarded blanket had fallen in the shape of a man, but the bed was empty. Bewildered, Robin rose to her feet and turned back towards the entrance of the cave. The Karunga woman stood by the fire, watching her expressionlessly, while little Juba hung back fearfully at the far side of the clearing. "Where is he?" Robin spread her hands to emphasize the question. "Where is Manali?" The Karunga woman dropped her eyes. For a moment, Robin did not understand, and then she too looked down at the grotesque figure that crouched by the fire at her feet. She felt a cold steel band lock about her chest and squeeze her heart, so that it took an effort of will to force her feet to move back across the swept floor of the cave. The Mashona woman was watching Robin expressionlessly. She had clearly not understood the English question, but she waited with the endless patience of Africa. Robin was about to appeal to her again, when the skeletal figure across the smoky little fire started to rock from side to side agitatedly, and a querulous, slurred old man's voice began to chant some strange litany like a magical incantation. It took Robin some moments to realize that the accents were faintly Scots, and the words, though blurred and jumbled, were a parody of the 23rd Psalm. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil." As suddenly as it had begun, the chanting broke off, and the rocking ceased. The frail figure froze into stillness and silence again. Across the fire, the Mashona woman stooped, and gently as a mother with a child, she drew back the kaross from the head and shoulder of the figure at her feet. Fuller Ballantyne had shriveled, his face lined and roughened like the bark of an old oak. It seemed as though the smoke of the fire had etched his skin, collecting in the creases, crusting it with soot. His hair and beard had fallen out in clumps, as though from some disgusting disease, and what was left of it was pure white, but stringed and darkened with dirt to a tobacco yellow at the corners of the mouth and at the nostrils. Only his eyes still seemed to live. They rolled in their sockets, and it needed only one look at them for Robin to realize that her father was mad. This was not Fuller Ballantyne. This was not the great explorer, the powerful evangelist, the enemy of slavery. He had gone long ago, leaving a filthy, shriveled lunatic in his place. "Peter," she stared at him in disbelief, feeling the world spin and lurch beneath her. "Peter," she repeated. And across the fire the crouched figure gibbered with abrupt, falsetto, girlish laughter, and then began to rave incoherently, snatches of English giving way to a half-dozen dialects of Africa. The cries becoming more agitated. his thin, pale arms thrown wildly in the air. "I have sinned against thee, my God!" he screamed and clawed at his own beard, a tuft of the thin, pale hair coming away in the hooked fingers. "I am not worthy to be thy servant!" He tore at himself again, this time leaving a thin, livid scratch down the pouched and wrinkled cheek, though it seemed that the wasted body had no blood left to shed. The Mashona woman leaned over him and caught the bony wrist, restraining him. The action was so familiar that she must have performed it often. Then, gently, she stooped and lifted him. The body seemed to weigh no more than that of a child, for she carried him without visible effort to the crude pole bed. One of his legs was bound up in a rudimentary splint and stuck straight out ahead of him. Robin stayed on beside the fire, hanging her head. She found that she was still shivering until the woman came back to her, touching her arm. "He is very sick." Only then could Robin force back her revulsion and her horror. She stood, hesitated only a moment longer, and then went to her father. With Juba and the Mashona woman helping her, she began her examination, taking refuge behind her professional rituals and procedures while she regained control of her emotions. He was thinner than she had ever seen a living human being. Thinner than the starved brats of gin-soaked slum sluts. "There has been little food," said the woman, "and what there is he will not eat. I have had to feed him like a small baby." Robin did not then understand what she meant, but she went on grimly with her examination. The starved body was verminous, the bunches of little white nits hanging like grapes in the thin white pubic hair, and his whole body was crusted with filth and traces of his own incontinence. Feeling under the staring ribcage, her fingertips encountered the hard, distended shape of liver and spleen, and Fuller Ballantyne screamed when she did so. The swelling and extreme tenderness were certain indications of massive malarial infection of long duration and evidence of terrible neglect. "Where is the medicine, the umuti of Manali?" "It was long ago finished, together with the powder and shot for the gun. Everything was finished long ago." The woman shook her head. "Long, long ago, and when it was finished, the people no longer came with gifts to feed us." It was suicidal to remain in a malarial area without supplies of quinine. Fuller Ballantyne, of all people, knew that. The acknowledged world expert on malarial fever and its treatment. How could he have neglected his own often repeated advice? She found the reasons almost immediately as she opened his mouth, forcing open his lower jaw despite his feeble protests. Most of his teeth had been rotted out by the disease, and his throat and palate were covered by the characteristic lesions. She released his jaw, allowing him to close the ruined mouth, and gently she touched the bridge of his nose, feeling the soggy, collapsing bone and gristle. There could be no doubt at all. The disease was far advanced, had long ago begun its final assault upon the once magnificent brain. It was syphilis. In the terminal stages, the general paralysis of the insane, the disease of the lonely man that led inevitably to this lonely madman's death. As Robin worked, so her horror and revulsion gave way swiftly to the compassion of the healer, to the sympathy of one who had lived with human weakness and folly, and had come far along the road of understanding. She knew now why her father had not turned back when his supplies of vital medicines ran perilously low. The half-destroyed brain had not recognized the dangers which had previously described so clearly. She found herself praying for him as she worked, praying silently, but the words coming out more readily than they usually did. "Judge him as he was, O Lord. Judge him by his service in your name, not by his small sins, but by his great achievements. Look not upon this ruined, pathetic thing, but on the strong and vital man who carried your work forward without flinching." As she prayed, she lifted the heavy kaross off his legs, and the smell of corruption made her blink, and the frail figure began immediately to struggle with renewed strength that needed both Juba and the Mashona woman to control. Robin stared at the legs and realized the other reason why her father had never left this land. He had been physically unable to do so. The splints that held the leg had been whittled out of native timber. The leg had been fractured, probably at more than one place, below the hip. Perhaps the hip joint itself had gone, that vulnerable neck of the femur. But what was certain was that the breaks had not mended cleanly. Perhaps the bindings of the splints had been too tight, for the deep suppurating ulcerations went down to the very bone, and the smell was a solid, jarring thing. Quickly she covered his lower body. There was nothing she could do until she had her medical chest and instruments, and now she was merely inflicting unnecessary pain and humiliation. Her father was still struggling and bleating like a petulant child, rolling his head from side to side, the toothless mouth darkly agape.